this sober mind, intoxicated tongue, with that smooth talk, hot like the sun. Hitting the interviews, yeah, we doing the thing, cause our guests keep it lit straight on the scene. Whether it's stories, hobbies, or just the job in life, best believe we spark it off and do it right. So stay tuned, cause we about to take flight, take it a new height, yeah, this that podcast, where we having a blast and getting it done, cause you and now in the mix.
Welcome everybody to the Sober Mind Intoxicated Tongue podcast. On today's episode, we have a very special guest, somebody who I'm super excited to talk to, just because it hits home pretty well. So, thank you, Marshall, so much for joining me. You are the writer of the book Stroke Forward. There you go. You are a stroke survivor, and now you're an advocate for people who. Who essentially had a stroke.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let me start from the beginning, as far as like right before your stroke. How can you tell me how your life was a little bit leading up to your stroke?
Sure. So I had a really normal life. I ran 3 or 4 times a week, and I went to actually I worked for myself.
Oh, okay.
And my husband and I came up to the lake. So we've got a lake house. So we came up every weekend and we had just a simple life.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you didn't have any, after you had the stroke, did the doctors ever give you an explanation or an idea as to why you had the stroke?
So I had a carotid artery dissection, and there's only 1-2% of people who actually have that happen. The doctors have no idea why I had the stroke. So it came out of the blue. So I had cholesterol was in the normal range. I was actually pretty young to have a stroke. I was 53.
Right.
And I'm saying that it's not really clear, because although older people are more likely to have a stroke, mm-hmm. people can have strokes from birth to end of life.
Okay.
They can have it anywhere in between.
Wow. So I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So it just brings me what is the difference between a stroke and a brain aneurysm?
Right. So a brain aneurysm is a bubble in the arteries in your brain. Mm-hmm. And once it bursts, you have a brain bleed, which is a stroke.
Okay. Okay.
And so I guess a brain aneurysm is pre-stroke.
Oh.
But it's actually a condition all of its own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So more people have brain aneurysms than have stroke for the 17% of people who have a brain bleed.
Okay.
So go ahead. So the rest of people have a clot that forms in their brain. Mm. And that's an ischemic stroke. And that's interesting because my mother had an aneurysm that burst.
Oh, wow.
So she had a brain bleed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it, I guess that, well, you think that's hereditary at all? Or do you think it's just kind of coincidental?
I think for me, it is hereditary, but I didn't really think about it at the time. So my grandma had a stroke at 77 and died.
Oh, wow.
My great uncle had a stroke. So I guess I thought it was something that happened to older people,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't an old person yet. So right. Why would I have a stroke? Well, anyone can have a stroke.
Yeah. I know, at that age, I was still fairly young to have any such traumatic, thing happen to them, so definitely young. Let me ask you, talk to us that day on that you had the stroke, and how kind of just the event itself, when it first started to, you know, when you got taken to the hospital.
Okay. So it was Sunday morning, and I woke up and I knew that I felt weird. Mm-hmm. So I reached for my phone and I texted my friend Rochelle to tell her that I wouldn't meet her for breakfast. And I couldn't read my text. Oh, wow. But, well, that's weird. Well, I'll text her later. That was what I thought. So I put my phone down, I rolled over, and had the worst headache imaginable. And despite the pain, I fell asleep.
Wow.
The next time I woke up, I knew I was in real trouble because my right side was paralyzed. And I knew that I had to get help. Now, I could hear the TV on downstairs, so I knew my husband was home. Mm-hmm. So I fell out of bed and I dragged myself across the carpet using my left hand. And I finally made it all the way to the door, which was locked. I had to reach up and grab it. And I don't know how many times I reached up to grab it, but because I couldn't actually reach the door handle. Mm-hmm. So somehow it got lucky and it snuck open. And I just laid there for a while because I was drenched in sweat and I didn't have any energy. Wow. To move forward. I finally got the energy to move forward, and I dragged myself halfway down the hall, and I ran out of gas.
Oh, wow. Now, did your husband find you there? Or?
He did. So I knew he would come up for soda. But something fell. I don't know what it is, but something fell that day. And he came upstairs, and he found me and said, "Marcia, are you okay?" Mm-hmm. And that's the point I realized I couldn't speak.
Oh, wow.
So he said, "Can you talk to me?" And I went, And he said, "I'm going to call 911. And he did. And he looked around upstairs and he couldn't find anything. So he came outside and sat by me and waited for the paramedics to arrive.
Wow. Now, did he?
And
Go ahead. Was he aware that or conscious about that you were having a stroke, or was that not even?
No. Okay. So the paramedics probably took 5 to 10 minutes to arrive. And the first questions they asked when they came through the door is, "When did she have the stroke?"
Oh.
And then he was figuring out, uh-oh. Yeah, that was a pretty terrifying moment because that's a really bad word now, for us.
Now, were you able to talk at all? Like, or you were just no. Like, no, okay.
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I know I talked to you before and probably throughout this whole episode, I will kind of bring my dad into the equation a little bit because it really resonates with my dad's story a little bit because, you know, like I said, my dad does suffer from speech right now, with the whole aphasia part. So the whole stroke story itself, I mean, I'm gonna go back to say my dad, you know, my dad's situation. I'm gonna compare it a lot. So
that's okay.
So the paramedics finally get there and they say the word stroke. did you hear that or was it just?
No, I did hear it. So I actually heard it. I didn't have a tremendous reaction to it because I was almost completely out of it. So I lost consciousness in the ambulance on the way to the hospital.
Okay.
Now the hospital or the paramedics told my husband not to speed on his way to the hospital. But the only thing that I remember that day in the hospital is that when I woke up, I was dressed in a hospital gown. Mm-hmm. there was a needle in my arm, and my husband was by my side. Oh, wow. And that was that. Yeah.
Wow. So, I guess I don't want to jump too forward or too ahead of ourselves, but as far as like the memory wise, I know I've asked my dad plenty of times what he remembers or recalls from that day that he had his stroke, and it seems to me that either he can't fully kind of say what happened, or he doesn't remember. I think most of it just he doesn't remember. For the most part, you have a very from your story, you do have a very good memories afterwards as well, right?
Up until when I lost consciousness, I could remember everything before that.
Okay.
Afterwards, I am less clear, because in the hospital, I would have doctors, nurses, whoever came in to the hospital room, and they talked to me, and I'd understand what they had to say. They'd walk out, and I couldn't remember anything that they'd said. Oh, wow. So I had a very short-term attention span and short-term memory loss. Wow. Yeah.
Now, how long before you were able to, I guess, not maybe complete a sentence, but a few words to start coming out?
So I could probably say yes or no the next day.
Okay. And that's as far as you go.
I could probably say a couple other words, but right. That was it. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So, from what I remember talking to the doctors at the hospital, not so much yes, but my dad's favorite word was no. they said pretty much that's a very common thing where he even had a hard time kind of, he was confusing his yeses and his no's. So mm-hmm. Is that something that you had a problem with as well, or?
No. I knew yes or no, and I said them sometimes. So when people were in the hospital, and so I'll tell you, the nurse came into the room one day mm-hmm. and told me to count to 10, right?
Right.
And I decided to count to 10 in Norwegian. And I had taken Norwegian in college.
Okay.
I spent 10 months in Norway. So, and I could remember the numbers. So it's like, I'll use Norwegian. So I counted to 10 in Norwegian. And she looked at me and she was very disturbed. And she said, "You'd be better off if you use your own language."
That's funny.
But other than that, sometimes I couldn't say a thing.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes I could say a few sentences mm-hmm. or words. Sometimes I just would climb up and say nothing.
Now, again, the way that my dad has kind of explained it to me a little bit, from the little that he can explain it, is kind of at the way he explains it to me is by me asking him like pretty much yes or no questions. And so, you know, like sometimes he's able to say a few words here and there, but from what I got from him is that sometimes he can't, he's doing like a sentence and then all of a sudden he just forgets the sentence, or other explanations he's given me is that he knows what he wants to say, but his mouth is just not, you know, not saying what yeah. he wants to, or it just doesn't want to come out at all. Is that?
Yeah. So you can know exactly what you want to say mm-hmm. and you can't say a word. It just won't come out. So you think of another way of saying a similar thing.
Right.
And sometimes the similar thing will come out, but it won't be the same as what you actually wanted to say.
Okay. Yeah, it's no, go ahead.
So for me, it was like having two people in my head. So here's the one person who wanted to say exactly what I wanted to say. And here's the other person who could kind of say maybe something that was a little bit similar.
Mm, Okay.
And sometimes I could say it and sometimes I couldn't.
Right.
So it, you have to think about, are you scared, nervous, excited, tired? Mm-hmm. I mean, any of those things could disrupt your ability to speak.
Okay. What would you say that, I guess, made you speak a little bit better or more sentences? Was it if you were happy? Or, because what I noticed, when I noticed about my dad, sometimes when he, especially when he is with somebody who, I mean, I guess he doesn't, that he really appreciates or likes, like a friend or a cousin or brother, whatever, he gets a little overexcited and he wants to speak, but the more excited he gets, I guess the less he focuses on what he wants to say.
Yeah.
and vice, you know, so.
Yeah. It's a weird disease. And so the National Aphasia Association says that if you're not cured of this within the first 3 months of when you have onset, mm-hmm. you will likely have it for life.
Okay.
And I found my cure 3.5 years after.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of scary to think about when you just said that in 3 months. I'm like, well, that sucks for my dad, for us, you know. But so you said 3.5 years after you had
yeah.
your stroke. Okay. Now let's go. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your treatments. I know what kind of treatments did you get at first? Was it like, you know, your typical speech therapy and stuff like that?
Yeah. So. In the hospital, they dragged me up and down the corridor a couple of times. And then I went to a rehab hospital. And in the rehab hospital, I had occupational therapy, speech therapy, and physical therapy.
Okay.
And when I got to the rehab hospital, I was still in a wheelchair. When I left the rehab hospital, I was using a cane. Mm. And I was in the rehab hospital for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So the rehab hospital, you get 3 hours of treatment. So physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy for me.
Right.
Every day, except for the weekends.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's very...
And go ahead.
I said that's very similar to like what my dad kind of did, where he would get after he was released from the hospital, he went to a rehab center, and then that's where he mm-hmm. would do his rehabilitation with the therapies of speech and occupational and so on and so on.
Yeah. So when I got out of the rehab hospital, I had 6 weeks of home therapy. Mm-hmm. And after that, I had 2 weeks off, and then I had outpatient therapy for 2 months.
Okay.
And at that point, I didn't have speech therapy, but I had occupational therapy and physical therapy. And at the end of that time frame, I still walked very badly, I think.
Okay.
And so I actually paid a physical therapist to work with me for a year.
Oh, wow.
To get my body back into, I'm going to say, normal working order. It's not normal.
Right.
But it looks pretty normal.
Now, during the, once you were done with the whole, before you went and got yourself a physical therapist, speech-wise, what level were you at?
We didn't actually look at levels, so I can't answer that.
I mean, but yeah.
So the last speech therapist I had told me that she'd given me everything she could, and I just needed to practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you that I appreciated her, but she had that wrong.
Right. How so?
So I was reading Dr. Seuss books.
Okay.
And I would read them out loud. And I had most of what was said out loud right. But talking to somebody is very different from reading out loud.
Okay.
And talking to somebody is you're sitting there and you're having to think of the words and think of the words that I knew what I wanted to say, but I couldn't say it. So I had to think of other words that maybe I could say. Mm-hmm. That was really tough. And so again, it could be, maybe I said nothing. Right. Maybe I said a few words. Maybe I was fully functional. In the early stages, I would talk like this. So I was really slow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you still weren't able to have a conversation like you and I are having right now?
No.
Okay.
It was not possible.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's mind blowing a little bit, you know, just to know that you're in that stage, you know. So once you, in your book, you talk a lot about the neurofeedback. Can you talk to me a little bit and some of the listeners, like what neurofeedback is and even some other treatments that you've had to really help you out with your speech?
Okay. So neurofeedback is, it has a device that's about twice the size of a smartphone.
Okay.
And it has EEG leads that come out of it. It has five EEG leads. Mm-hmm. And the doctor, you have to excuse the cat.
Oh, no problem.
The doctor puts them on your head, two positive, two negative, and a ground. And the neurofeedback device is connected to his computer, mm-hmm. right? So when he turns it on, I felt nothing.
Okay.
But I could see my brain waves, right?
Right.
And it was really weird because I was thinking, well, if I don't feel anything, is it really doing anything for me, mm-hmm. right? And he put them on to another place on my head. And we did it again. I'm still feeling nothing.
So at this point, it's already doing its thing. Is that what it's?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Okay. Okay. So when he got done, I felt giddy. So I'm going, okay. So the interesting thing was I spoke better that day. After my first session, I could speak better.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
going, I didn't know what it was, but I like it. So what it does is it takes 1/100th of a AAA battery.
Oh, okay.
And it puts it, pings it through your brain.
Hmm.
Right? So it ping, 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 ping.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And your brain apparently realizes that it is off. And it resets.
Oh, wow.
That's essentially what they told me.
Mm.
So I went in for 16 sessions. And after that, my speech was just like this.
Wow.
And I will say that 85% of traumatic brain injury survivors who have neurofeedback get better.
Wow. That's actually really a good statistic to hear, to be honest.
Yeah. So I actually looked through all this information that my doctor gave me, and he said, you have to look at this because I think this is something you really want to try. Mm-hmm. I went home, I looked at it, and I saw that statistic. I went, okay, I would be foolish not to try this
right.
because it looks like there would be no downside, mm-hmm. but a really big upside if it works. And for me, it worked.
Now, is there any, is there any side effects at all? Like, can there be any side effects at all? No? Okay.
No.
Now, let me ask you this, because I know I saw this on, I forgot where I saw this, but how do you get your doctors to, I guess, because a lot of time when I see a lot of the doctors in my dad sees, I see it might be like a cultural thing, I'm not too sure, but we listen to our doctors a lot and we trust our doctors to have our best interest. How can we push back a little bit to the doctors and say, hey, can we try this? I heard, you know, for example, if I go back to my dad's doctor and say, hey, I heard about this neurofeedback. Where can I go get this? Or, you know,
right. So I'm a terrible patient. So there are some doctors I just didn't gel with.
Right.
And I had just come out of the hospital and my husband was taking me to my neurologist. Mm-hmm. I just didn't like him. And so I'd probably been there. I'd gone to him probably 3 or 4 times. And I told my husband, I'm not going back. You know, I'm going to find somebody else, but he's not going to. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's how do you feel? Is he open to your suggestions?
Right.
If he's not open to your suggestions, maybe he's not the right one for you. Mm-hmm. I found that the doctors who work best for me are open to what I have to say.
Right.
They stop, they listen, and they try to figure out what's wrong with me and kind of the whole body, mm-hmm. not just what's wrong with my brain or what's wrong with my arm or leg or anything. They look at the whole me and go, okay, we're going to try this and see if it works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why I think it's important for people to understand that they have the option to look for doctors who will look for other things right. for them.
Now, how common is the neurofeedback, I guess, a lot of doctors aware of it, that a lot of neuro doctors aware of it, or is that why hasn't it been offered to us maybe?
That's the thing. I don't think that doctors are aware of it. So we didn't have neurofeedback, or I didn't know to ask for neurofeedback until my doctor got a neurofeedback device in his office.
Oh, okay.
3.5 years after I had my stroke. And I think he's one of 2 doctors in Virginia.
Wow.
That has one. Yeah.
Wow. that's
right.
That's crazy.
Right. So I think that neurofeedback is out there, but you have to be aware that it is, and you have to look for people who have it.
Okay. When I was actually doing, I think that my dad in particular, I think he would need too much. I mean, I truly feel that he's never going to be 100% just because how bad of a stroke he did have and his age as well. I think, do you think that age is a factor as far as like how you recover?
No.
No? Okay.
I don't. So I think that you can get better as long as you think you can.
Okay.
So I'm going to be getting better for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Wow. Because I want to be as close to 100% as possible. Mm-hmm. Am I going to make it? No. Does it matter? No. Because I'm going to still keep trying. So you know what I did today?
What's that?
I painted my house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask, like, you know, actually, you know, throughout your, especially in the beginning, were you ever, I guess, not necessarily just depressed, but were you ever, well, I guess, you know, were you depressed as far as, like, were you, you know?
No, I wasn't ever really depressed. So I always look at where I wanted to be. So when I got out of the rehab hospital, I said, at the 1 year mark, you're going to run a 5K.
Okay.
Now, one year came and I couldn't run.
Right.
So I said, fine, next year at the 2 year mark, you're going to run a 5K. 2 years came around and I wasn't running a 5K.
Okay.
So, but the deal is that I made a goal that in my mind was achievable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for it.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I guess my biggest, the reason I kind of asked that is just the point, or I guess the reason would be because I feel like there's a lot of people out there, such as my dad, that, well, even yourself, that never imagined that this would ever happen to them, and just being in that situation where I feel that maybe it's, to a certain degree, it's okay to be sad, but obviously, you know, with the optimistic, not every day is going to be a good day, and not every day is going to be a bad day as well.
Yeah, so I will tell you that not every day is a good day.
Okay.
But I will also tell you that, even on bad days, you have to get up the courage to do your exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my exercises every day. I was very faithful about it.
Okay.
Did I want to? Some days, no.
Right.
Some days I looked at things a little bluer than I am normally,
mm-hmm.
but I always looked at, you have to do these every day, because if you give up, if you just say, oh, I'm not going to do them today, and you get in this rut, it's so easy to go down right. the negative path.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do that.
Now, one of the reasons that I think that my dad had he did have a little bit of a stretch as far as like having a depression when he was still at the hospital. I think one of the reasons he got out of it was, and not fully got out of it, because there's bad days just like you said, but one of the reasons is because he has so many, you know, loved ones, you know, such as myself and, you know, my sister, my brothers, my mom were always all there, you know, like for the first year or two. Well, not two, because it hasn't even been 2 years, but easily the first year, we were always there, like almost every day at his house, or at, because he was at the hospital for the rehabilitation center for about 3 weeks, I think, 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So we were there every pretty much every day. Us brothers, some of them, you know, lived a little bit further away, and it was pretty far, so it was a little harder. But for the most part, we were always there. Did you have a lot?
And that's so. So first of all, that's so important for a person to have that care, especially right away.
Right.
I think that a person is like the five closest people to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if the people is surrounded by people that are loving and caring and positive, they're going to come out of it probably positive, and the caring will make them work harder for right. something.
Right.
So, yeah.
Did you have a lot of family that was around you, a lot of family and friends that was always there for you?
So my husband was there, and he called my sister and her husband, and he asked if they would come. So they live in Washington State.
Oh, wow.
And we live in Virginia.
Total opposites.
And she's a CPA. And it was just before tax season.
Oh, my gosh.
Is ending. And they came.
Oh, wow.
She put people's on their extension, their file extension.
Oh, okay.
And she came.
Wow.
But for the most part, I was alone, except for my husband. Occasionally, he'd have a friend come over, but he was really picky about who could see me, because when I got people in front of me, especially in the beginning, I would just shut down.
Really?
Because I was excited.
Right.
And I couldn't talk.
Oh, yeah.
So he just monitored who could actually come in and see me. Wow. So I couldn't actually see people for months.
Do you think that was a right move, or I wouldn't say question, because I obviously he had his your best interest at hand, but do you think they would have been a little bit easier in the beginning if he would have had a little bit more friends and family come over to see you?
Well, so my family is way far away.
Oh, right.
So family is pretty much out of it, except that my family came a couple times that year. And my friends, like I said, I had friends over by like one friend at a time.
Okay.
Every few days or every week or so. I think for me it worked.
Okay.
You know,
Go ahead.
So I mean, there's also like, I was slow in processing information,
mm-hmm.
right? I was slow in responding to their questions. So if someone asked me a question, they'd have to wait for me to respond.
Right.
And that's actually a good thing. So all my friends are really good about waiting.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
I do recall when we're at the rehabilitation center, or I call it a hospital because I know it's still a hospital regardless. But I remember specifically that the doctors or doctor would say like, hey, if you're having a lot of guests in here, which we did a lot of times, we had a lot of people in there. They told us specifically, like, try not to have side conversations with your family members I forgot the exact reason, but I think it was because it might be overwhelming for the patient. And to try to tell the family to not have side conversations, it was really hard to be honest. You know, we did, but then they didn't listen that much, and you know, which is not nothing, you know, that we're mad about that day. So
yeah. So my aunt died in September of that year. So I had my stroke in 2014,
mm-hmm.
and she died in September. And my husband and I went back for her funeral. And walking into the funeral home was so daunting,
mm-hmm.
because it was filled with people. I like all the people that, or love, depending on who they are, all the people in the that we saw around us. But there's so much pressure. And I heard so many people talking at the same time, and it was all kind of one thing.
Right.
But I completely shut down.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, I stuck on to my husband, and my sister was there too. And just, I was there, but I was not there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And actually, that actually stayed for a long time. So I could stay with one person if we were in a conversation. I could live with two people,
mm-hmm.
in a conversation for a little bit. But more than that, I was just really flummoxed.
Wow.
Yeah.
That just, it's a little concerning just knowing how many people, especially in the beginning, how many people or family members would come in, and we would all have like, pretty much, I guess that's the only thing I really liked about, I mean, if there's anything to like about being at a hospital, you do get to see a lot of the family members that you don't see quite often.
Right.
And it was almost, it was a very, very, especially when you're having going through such a traumatic event, like to have family around you that knows that you know that love you and are there for you no matter what. To me, it was a good thing. Now thinking back, it's a little concerning knowing that my dad has such a could have had a hard time with it. So,
yeah.
So what else? When you got out your whole rehabilitation point, how has your diet changed? Whether it's to better your health or your palate. So, because I heard a lot of doctors we would like to make fun of my mom and my sister because. Since my dad doesn't want to eat something, it's like, oh, you know, they start pointing out that he used to like it, but now after the stroke, he doesn't like it anymore. Which I remember I remember the doctor saying that, but I think to a certain degree they hype it up a little too much, where it's not exactly the case.
Right. So I lost my sense of taste.
Okay.
So when we went out to eat, I would like to go to Red Robin all the time because I would taste their hamburgers and their onion rings. Mm. And everything else that we went to, I couldn't taste.
Wow.
So I think it was about a year, and all my taste buds came back by that time. But I guess for me, things didn't change that much. No.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. Except I like to go to Red Robin because I could eat their hamburgers.
And don't they got endless fries, I believe?
Yeah.
So can you tell me about the other therapies that you had? I know there's another one that I saw you list. It was a neurofeedback and then electrostify or something like that?
Low-level laser therapy. Low-level light therapy, yeah.
Okay.
So that I actually had laser therapy before neurofeedback. So I was at the two-year point. I had aphasia, and I had someone that I'd met at a meetup come up to me and say, he had been in a car accident, and he was really fuzzy about words when he was speaking. So he went to this doctor and had laser therapy, and it helped him. I thought, okay, so I wouldn't have believed you before the stroke, but now I'm desperate for something.
Right.
So I will try it out. So I went to the doctor and asked him about it. And he said, I don't know. It's been 2 years. You have recovered as much as you can from the stroke. I don't know if you'll get anything out of laser therapy, but we can try it. And if we aren't better by 4 or 5 times, it's not for you. I went, okay, fine. So I tried it out. And again, it's a little bit bigger than a smartphone. And he put the laser up by where I had my stroke. And it was there for 5 minutes. He said, when the laser's there, I want you to do the cross crawl. And that's when your arm and leg go up and you're doing this, right? Okay. And when I left, the aphasia was a little bit better.
Okay.
Maybe that's the wrong way to say it. I could speak better. Right. Not a lot better, but some better. And I actually still do the laser therapy because you can actually get treatment for something for Alzheimer's. And I thought, if I can do something that will prevent me from getting Alzheimer's, then I'm going to do it.
Right.
And so anybody who's had a brain injury like mine, a stroke, is 25% more likely to get Alzheimer's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a pretty big deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know my dad has pretty bad memory, to be honest. I always tell people who I try to explain how my dad is doing as far as like the memory-wise. I'm like, see, the hard thing for me or for us to really know is either he can't say what, if I ask him something like, hey, what'd you have for dinner or what'd you have for lunch today? Either he can't say it or he literally doesn't remember, or maybe he does remember, but he just really is having a hard time, you know, getting it out. So it's really hard for us to really tell what he doesn't remember and what he does remember. So, but I know for sure that post stroke, he's definitely has a harder time remembering like the stuff that happened after the stroke for sure.
Yeah. So there is a company called Lingraphica that has things that, like, they have iPods and things that go on iPods that may help him think of words. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at Lingraphica as maybe a way to look for things, because, I mean, so many people kind of get tired of a person who can't talk, right?
Right.
So there's that side. But the other side is when you can't talk, you lose a little piece of yourself every little time.
Oh, yeah.
So you kind of feel like it's not worth trying after a while. Mm-hmm. And if you feel like it's not worth trying, then you kind of close up and close down and maybe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might think about the things that are out there, like Lingraphica, speech group, speech therapy. Maybe there's a local stroke support group that he can go to.
Mm-hmm.
But those things kind of make you come out of your shell a little bit.
Yeah, one thing that my brother and I, or even, you know, my whole family noticed is that when he was doing speech therapy, this is before, you know, like right before Corona hit, was or a little bit more before Corona, pretty much. He was doing speech therapy, and we noticed that every time that he had therapy that day, he was able to communicate a little bit better. So just in that moment or that day itself, we definitely noticed that it made such a big difference as far as, you know, that goes. So definitely having him out there, I guess, talking a little bit more. My dad's always been a quiet person, but, you know, with the stroke, obviously, with, you know, it's a very, he's had a hard time just, you know, like, he gets frustrated, you know, easily with not being able to speak. I mean, which is, you know, understandable for sure. So now,
I think I will send you a link to a group that will probably be very beneficial for your father.
Okay, appreciate that. Do you now, one of the things that he's kind of said is the fact that, and you yourself mentioned a little bit, he's had he was concerned why he can't read anymore. He was able to read before, and now he's not able to read. Now you kind of said the same thing where you sent it out that text message, or no, you received that text message and you weren't able to read it correctly. Is that was that correct?
Yep. So reading was terrible for me. And so it took me 4.5 years to get my book out.
Oh, wow.
And it's not that big of a book. So you have to think about how to spell a word before writing it. And sometimes think about having to spell it can take a long time. So I could write 2 paragraphs in a single day, and it could take me hours to write those 2 paragraphs.
Okay. Wow.
And it would be, sometimes I could think of how the word started. Sometimes it was typing it, and my fingers on my right side just wouldn't type very well.
Right.
So it was a long time learning how to just think through the words again.
Wow.
So I actually got better at reading, possibly because I wanted to write a book.
Right. Wow. That's intense.
Yeah.
So just before we kind of wrap up a little bit, what would you tell listeners who are going through this, either themselves or has, you know, family members such as myself that are, you know, have had it, what would be one of the biggest things that you would tell the listeners?
Okay. So I would say to the stroke survivors, never give up.
Never give
okay.
up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I would say for the caregivers, first of all, you're doing a really awesome job, because stroke is a terrible disease that lasts a lifetime.
Right.
And so thank you very much. Seriously. And just remember to take time out, a breather from being a caregiver for yourself. Because you have to have some time alone.
Right.
Just even to breathe.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you one more question before on that topic itself. You know, we all, I said, I live with my brother, and, you know, we share, my sister's married and doing her own thing, but she does go visit pretty often, I mean, every day pretty much, and us brothers, we rotate as far as, like, staying the night over at my parents' house just because, you know, my mom's elderly too, and, you know, even though she's in good health, you know, what would happen if my mom has, something happens to her and my dad's not able to, you know, do anything about it? What would you tell my mom in that situation? Not just that situation, but as far as, like, being able to... Because I feel like my mom, although she... I mean, she loves my dad so much that she worries so much. What would you tell her? I mean, just kind of that sense of, like, take a time to for yourself, you know?
So the time alone is not selfish. The time alone means that you are giving yourself the space to breathe,
right,
eat, reflect, meditate, work out, even go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are important for everyone because that means that you have a life.
Right.
And there's got to be somebody else that comes in and takes care of your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a separate life.
Yeah, because it seems to me that, you know, like I said, my mom is so caring and so, and, you know, loves my dad so much that at times for me, I feel that she's, I wouldn't say overly, but definitely a person who worries about him so much that it almost concerns me about her health, you know, like, take some time for yourself, you know, go out with my sister and do your thing and don't worry about
right.
that, you know, obviously we will take care of them. And even sometimes just stepping outside to go do something outside by herself, you know, she still has to worry about my dad a little bit. So
I understand that because even 6 years after my stroke, my husband is still very protective of me. It's like, come on, take some time off for yourself too. Just, you have to go out and breathe.
Right. Now, were you, like I say, you were able to, pretty much able to speak. You're very cognitively there. I mean, most people would you say that most people who have strokes are cognitively there as far as, like, knowing what's right and what's not right?
I think it depends upon the stroke.
Okay.
So I had a stroke just in front of my left ear, and this caused me to have trouble speaking,
right?
Some people have a stroke in the front of the brain, and they have trouble deciding the difference between right and wrong.
Okay.
So it really depends on where your stroke happens.
Okay, so not every stroke is the same.
So every stroke is different. Yeah.
Are there can you have like can you have some, like, for example, you said you had your stroke in next year. Can somebody else have it in the same spot and have different parts of your body affected?
So I think that if they had a stroke that was in the left side of their body or left side of their brain, like I did, they would possibly lose control of the right side of their body.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's exactly what my dad had too. So,
Right. That's what I, that's why I said, I think he's got aphasia. And so it was really interesting because I have a very, I think, analytical mind. Mm-hmm. When I had my stroke, I thought everything was right. I thought for my right side for the first time for a long time. It was really different because everything is touchy-feely. Right. So it took me a long time to gain some perspective between the two. Mm-hmm. I think now I'm more of a, I would like to say I'm more centered right. in the way I think about things. I thought that was really different.
Did you lose any, I know you touched a little bit on your right hand not being fully functional. Did you, how bad was your hand or your right hand?
So I couldn't grip, I couldn't grip my hand at all.
Oh, wow.
It took me a long time to actually, grip things. I'm trying to think of like a clothespin. Mm-hmm. So when I was in rehab, they gave me a clothespin and I could kind of grip it with the forefinger and thumb.
Right.
But the other ones just didn't do much. Yeah. After rehab and home health care, I could grip it, but I couldn't pinch.
Oh, okay.
So I think I could probably grip probably 9 months after a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I could actually squeeze it open a little bit, probably 9 months after.
Okay. Yeah, it seems to me like it's such a slow process. One thing that I tell my dad, and you know, sometimes when he's having like a bad day or whatever, or we just get to talking and I'm just like, Dad, you know, obviously nobody wants to see you like this, but you, at least through my perspective, is like, it didn't take you, this didn't happen to you overnight. So I wouldn't expect you to be, you know, 100%, you know, overnight either. Where, you know, my dad did have, you know, he wasn't a very big guy, but he did definitely, you know, focus on his work and his diet was not as good. So, and he had bad habits. You know, he was a smoker for, you know, a long time. So I'm assuming that also had to do a lot with his stroke. And he also did have a heart attack as well. So it was a double.
Oh,
so it was a double whammy right there. But yeah, he's the weird thing about how his right side stopped working is that when he was at the hospital, everything was working perfectly from what I saw. And slowly but surely, he started losing his right arm, as far mm-hmm. as like, you know, being able to move it. And when he got to the rehabilitation center, he had absolutely no movement on his right side of his arm or hand, his whole hand.
So how far does the movement, so can he raise his arm?
Now he can raise it. I would say probably about halfway.
Okay.
Yeah, halfway up. Okay. But like I said, once he got out of the hospital or the rehab center, like he couldn't use it at all still. So where he was still, he would still fall in once in a while, just because I'm assuming because of the balance, he wasn't, you know, able to have a great balance because of his hand, I'm assuming.
Yeah. But, so I will tell you that I also fell a few times. So I said that it's important that you get up. I worried a little bit when I fell, but I still got up and mm-hmm. walked. And I didn't tell my husband. Now, I would fall sometimes out for a walk with my friends. I'd say, shh, don't tell anyone. and they didn't.
Right.
They didn't.
That's good. That's good friends.
Yeah, I don't know if my husband would agree with them.
Do you ever feel that, are you afraid or have you ever felt or been in a situation where you're like, oh crap, am I having another stroke? Have you ever had that feeling? No? Okay.
No. I haven't.
Are you afraid of have another stroke? Like,
not anymore. No. So the first year I probably was a little bit afraid, but I finally realized that for me, I could think about that and be afraid, or I could not think about it. And if I had another stroke and deal with it at that time. Mm-hmm. But the more you think about it means that you're not thinking about the things that you want to do in your life.
Right. That's great. Great advice.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I think that's going to wrap it up. Do you have anything you would like to share with the listeners that you wouldn't really talk about?
Sure. So if they want to buy my book, it's available on Amazon.com. It's called Stroke Forward. Mm-hmm. And if they want to visit my website, it's also strokeforward.com.
And I will leave it in the show notes as well. So put a link on both my Facebook and my Instagram. So remember, guys, to go visit Smit Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, SMIT Podcast. Thank you, Marshall, so much for joining me. I had a wonderful time talking to you about this, and hopefully, you know, we can look into some of the things, you know, that we talked about. And thank you, like I said, thank you again so much, because I think you give me hope for sure. So, and I hope that you give a lot of other people hope as well.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right, guys, that'll wrap it up for today.